You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear about a program that gives away free fresh produce that is harvested from research at the UW-Madison.
First, the New York Times reported last night that the U.S. Department of Justice plans to investigate and possibly sue colleges over their affirmative action admissions policies if it finds they discriminate against white applicants.
Kevin Brown is a professor at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What exactly is in these plans that were discovered that the U.S. Department of Justice was circulating?
Sure. The New York Times story was somewhat sketchy on details, but basically what they said is there's an internal document that's circulating about trying to put together a separate division that would investigate and possibly litigate intentional race-based discriminations in college and university admissions. It doesn't specifically say they're going after affirmative action programs, but one would think that that would be the target of such language, especially given what seems to be the bent of the Trump administration. And the idea, I guess, would be to put together a separate team that's outside of the Department of Justice's educational opportunity section and staff it with people outside of that section to do this work.
And my understanding is that it was actually in the form of a job posting. It was basically asking internal candidates to express interest in this potential new position. Is that correct?
Exactly right. The Justice Department put out a statement at about noon today saying, no, this is overblown, that we're not really changing our policy at all. This is just simply a personnel posting, and we litigate intentional acts of discrimination on college by colleges and universities all the time.
But would it be fair to say that in general, the Civil Rights Division is looking at discrimination against students who would fall into a protected class currently, not against students from a dominant group that might be, quote unquote, losing out to those other students?
Yeah, I think that would probably be right. That there's always been concern on colleges and universities about their affirmative action programs, but the Obama administration didn't make attacking affirmative action programs a priority. If, in fact, the Trump administration is going to do that, that would clearly be a change over what we've seen over the last 8 years.
And in the information that has come out about this, do we have a sense of where the impetus for this was coming from? Is it coming from Attorney General Jeff Sessions? Is it coming from the White House? Or do we just not know at this point?
Yeah, we don't know at this point. Certainly given some of the things in Sessions' background, one wouldn't be surprised as Attorney General if he decided to target affirmative action programs. And given the number of voters that Trump had, I wouldn't, especially a small percentage of voters in the Black and Latino ranks, one wouldn't be surprised that he didn't feel like he needed to curry favor with those voters either.
And if you can take us through, Kevin, what happens when there is an investigation into an affirmative action complaint? What does the Department of Justice do, and what are their options in pursuing something?
Sure. So the Department of Justice will send a letter to the college or university, let them know that they're under investigation. And that typically means that that university is going to have to produce a number of documents for the investigators to look at. If, in fact, Justice Department feels like there is a potential violation, they can then enter into negotiations about a settlement that can be worked out without going to litigation. But, of course, if there is no settlement, then it would head on to litigation.
We're talking with Kevin Brown right now. He's a professor at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law, and we're talking about documents that the New York Times got access to showing that the U.S. Department of Justice may be considering going after colleges and universities for affirmative action policies that may go against white applicants. Now, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, weighed in on affirmative action last year in a case involving the University of Texas at Austin. Can you remind us what happened with that case?
Sure. That was the Fisher case, and that was actually the second time that case had gone to the Supreme Court. The court upheld effectively its earlier ruling in Fisher, where it upheld what the University of Texas was doing. I think the thing that's kind of striking about the Fisher's case is that the University of Texas had tied their concept of critical mass, which the Supreme Court had accepted back in the Grutter case, the University of Michigan affirmative action case in 2003. Texas had tied the concept of critical mass to the percentage of minorities in the state. And I think there were a lot of people who thought that might be going too far. But given that Justice Kennedy, who was the deciding vote, and he still is the deciding vote today, was willing to say what the University of Texas did was constitutional, I would suspect at least right now the Supreme Court has 5 votes to uphold the current practice of affirmative action. So that if there were attacks that were being done by Department of Justice on current policies, it's more likely to have a chilling effect as opposed to a legal effect. It'll force colleges and universities to be a little more circumspect in their programs and policies, and indeed may even be willing to eliminate them, thinking that's a safer route to go, even though those things may be constitutional. Colleges and universities clearly don't want to spend the kind of money that it's going to take to defend an action if it's brought by justice.
And looking at the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division and there being kind of different parts of the department, how political are those departments from administration to administration, or do they tend to stay fairly above the fray?
Yeah, so you'll have a lot of civil servants who will hold over from one administration to another, but the administration gets to set the broad policy. Just as an example, the Clinton administration made attacks on school discipline and tracking a serious concern, racial disparities in school discipline and tracking a serious concern. But the Bush administration didn't. So those kind of lawsuits disappeared after George Bush became president in 2000. So, yes, the Trump administration can, in fact, influence the kind of litigation that justice would do, even though a majority of those attorneys are still going to be civil servants who've been there through past administrations and will be there even through the Trump administration.
The United States has become increasingly multiracial, and projections are that, especially in some very large metro areas, whites are actually going to be in a minority. Would you say that affirmative action is as important today as it was perhaps 30 or 40 years ago?
Well, I'd say it's probably more important. And indeed, precisely because of what you're talking about, you're looking at changing demographics in American society, which means you really, what affirmative action is more about than anything, because it only applies to your most selective colleges, universities, and graduate programs. So probably 90% of our colleges and universities don't use affirmative action at all because they don't have selective admissions policies.
Because it's not as competitive.
But the elite educational institutions do. So your Ivy Leagues will, virtually all of your law schools, medical schools, your elite MBA programs will have affirmative action programs. So affirmative action programs ensure that in the leadership in our society, we have a diverse leadership. We have significant number of blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, and whites to help formulate policies for the rest of society. So it's very important in terms of making sure that our leadership reflects a broad spectrum of thought that's consistent with the broad spectrum of people in the U.S.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me.
That was Kevin Brown, professor at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. He joined us to talk about the just revealed plans from the U.S. Department of Justice to start investigating and possibly suing schools that use an affirmative action policy that could be detrimental to white students.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Sometimes we can plan and plan and plan, and things still don't work out. Justin Patchen set out with his camera to make the perfect shot, but things didn't go quite as he expected.
I'm running late. By the time I show up, the sun has already sunk beneath the horizon. Despite my best intentions, it appears I've missed the opportunity I was hoping for. I've always loved sunsets, but I only recently discovered a joy in photographing them to preserve and share with others. On this evening, I hiked to a spot on the Eau Claire River to capture the sun setting over a slow-moving section of the stream. I came across this place previously while boating and thought it'd be an interesting location to take a picture, though I didn't realize at the time what it would take to get there by foot. To reach the river, I descend a ski-slope steep hill with uneven terrain and weave through waist-high weeds beneath the power line. So many potential pitfalls. Several hundred thousand volts above, and who knows what lurking below. It takes several minutes for me to negotiate the cliff. At the bottom, I depart the power line clearing and head toward the sun already set. Between me and the river is a forest of mature oaks. I walk warily in the dimness of the thick canopy for a while before arriving at my destination, a small field of purple crowned vetch on the riverbank. A beautiful but invasive species, I envisioned the lavender flowers playing well with the blue water and golden sky. I had intended to arrive much earlier to give myself time to fully explore the spot to determine the perfect place to situate the camera for the best possible shot. But I don't. Instead, I hastily plop the tripod amid the flowering weeds and point the camera to the west. It appears to be an average western Wisconsin sunset, the kind I could see on any given gas station postcard. White wispy clouds and only a faint hint of color in the sky. Not exactly what I had in mind, and hardly worth the effort to get here. I consider abandoning the shot altogether, but since I've come this far, I've forced myself to snap a few photos. Usually when photographing sunsets, I'll take dozens, maybe even hundreds of frames with different settings and varying compositions. I'm still relatively new at this, so I need to experiment to see what works. Tonight, though, I'm tired and frustrated, and the mosquitoes are attacking me from all directions. To make matters worse, when I look at my feet to readjust my footing, I notice that I have set up on a patch of poison ivy. So after only a few minutes on site, I pack up my gear and head for the hill, dreading the return trip through the woods and weeds, now in near complete darkness. When I get home, I upload the images to my computer and am amazed that they turned out pretty well. Much better than I had thought. The colors pop in a way that I couldn't fully appreciate when I was in the moment. And while I'm still itching from the ivy and insects, I learn to pause in the instant to fully take in what is before me, an important lesson that'll probably take more time to sink in. A year later, I'll return to this same spot in an effort to improve upon the photo, but it won't be as good. It never is.
Justin Patchen is professor of criminal justice at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, we always hear there's no such thing as a free lunch. But what about free veggies left over from university research? Now there's good news for UW-Madison students who are tired of relying on ramen noodles week after week after week.
Hannah DePorter joins us now. She's a UW-Madison senior and founder of the Campus Food Shed. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, can you tell us where this idea for the Campus Food Shed came from?
Sure. So it came from two parts of my jobs, actually. So one of them would be that I was the administrative director for a sustainable agriculture organization on campus, and we grow a bunch of food, and one of our flagship programs is called Harvest Handouts, where we give out free produce to students and staff and community members in Madison on Fridays. And the other would be I work in a plant breeding lab as a student hourly. And during when we harvest all these vegetables to do the research, you only need X amount of roots, and there's just a lot that's left in the fields that end up being composted, so they're not really being wasted. But I was just seeing that that could go to a lot more people. And with this sustainable agriculture organization, we only give out vegetables for an hour a week, so that's not as accessible as it could be. And especially in the summer months, not everyone can come at 1 p.m. to get the vegetables, so we'd end up with extras and end up having to compost those as well. So I wanted to be able to extend the life of all of these vegetables that are just being wasted and put them into people's hands.
What kind of veggies were you composting, getting rid of that way?
So pretty much everything that you can think of that is grown in Wisconsin is what we're being composted. So like anything from beets to kale to zucchini, herbs, just pretty much everything.
Wow. So how come there's all this left over, especially for the plants that you're doing research on?
Well, you have to grow a certain amount especially like in plant breeding, when you're breeding for like the commercial industry, you need to grow a lot to see what will be best viable. And this is just for all agriculture, that there's no way to predict how the growing season is going to turn out or how much you need to grow for the demand. So it's better to have more than less, but if there's too much, then it's not good to be wasted.
And so you got this idea to have kind of stations, or I guess they're basically refrigerators scattered
yep.
around the campus area where people can help themselves. So walk us through how it works.
Sure. So we have four refrigerator locations. One is at the Student Activity Center, one is at Science Hall, one is at the Plant Sciences Building, and one is at Allen Centennial Gardens. And we chose those four locations because it's very spread out on campus. Two are on the west side of campus, two are on the east side of campus. So it creates a more accessible locations for individuals to go depending on where they are. And just how, like, all those places are always frequented by faculty, students, and staff. So we want to reach, you know, as many people as possible. So we have those locations. And anytime there's donations, people, like, in research labs or just local farms and the F.H. King Students for Sustainable Agriculture and a few other community groups, they'll just tell me that they're going to bring stuff, or I'll go pick it up. And then I will bring it to one of the locations. And then how I've been letting the community know that stuff is there is I take a picture of the refrigerator stocked, and then I post on Facebook the picture, what is in the fridge, and which fridge it is in, and like the hours that they can go.
Nice. And what kind of response have you gotten so far?
It exceeded my expectations. Everything is usually gone within 24 hours, putting stuff in. And some days we have 200 pounds of produce going in these refrigerators. And it's really, really great to see that I'll put something in on like a Wednesday evening and then come back Thursday morning and it's just taken. It's really great to see. So the response has just been incredible. Same with donations too. I was a bit nervous that people wouldn't bring stuff, or it would be too much of an inconvenience to bring stuff to the locations. But luckily, since one of our locations is in the Plant Science Building, a lot of these research labs are stationed out of that building. So when they're coming back from the research stations, it's just an easy drop off for them too.
Well, and students, you know, the idea of the ramen noodle eating student is out there for a reason. Sometimes you're really on a shoestring and you're struggling to put food in your belly. This has got to help a little with that and giving better options.
Yeah, that's really what I'm hoping too. The two goals of this project were to reduce food waste food waste and increase food security, because food insecurity on a this college campus is prevalent. It's not super visible, but like the campus open seat food pantry is also another great resource that is only a couple years old. So I'm glad that this can work in conjunction with that as well to alleviate the food insecurity.
Now, I'm guessing this is, you know, this is a trust thing. Anybody can come take some fruits and veggies. Sounds like it's mostly veggies. But do you have to be in the UW community if there's someone who's outside that community who could really use some help getting access to vegetables? Can they also visit these refrigerators?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we got a grant through the university, which is for the UW community. So we are focused only on the students, faculty, and staff. But a lot of just students alone is 42,000 people, and then you add thousands of more for faculty and staff. So we're already reaching up to like 50,000 people to use it. So I have been contacted by just community members, and then I've just been sending them information on other resources, because there are quite a few food pantries in the area and other programs that can get them access if they are food insecure.
And do you want to add more variety, more refrigerators? What's next?
Well, for now, I think the refrigerators, we have enough. I mean, maybe we would add another one because there has been so much. And just my next goal would be to work with local farmers who have extra leftovers as well, because there will always be leftovers pretty much, unless it's a bad growing season. So that is my next goal, is to just get more people involved in donating their extra produce.
Well, Hannah, thank you and congratulations. It sounds like a great idea.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Hannah DePorter, senior at UW-Madison and the founder of the Campus Food Shed, a program to give away free produce left over from research at UW-Madison.
First, in the wake of mass violence, one sentiment is commonly expressed. Here's Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, speaking in the aftermath of the Sandy Hook school shooting.
We do everything we can to keep our children safe. It's now time for us to assume responsibility for our schools. The only way to stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Well, that theory has picked up support in both political and academic circles. There is a strong body of research that shows that it may not be true.
John J. Donahue is a professor at the Stanford Law School and is also an economist. He uses empirical and data-focused research to look at issues including crime and criminal justice. And he was one of the lead authors on the recent study done by the National Bureau of Economic Research on whether more people with guns leads to increased public safety. John, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
What do we know about where public opinion stands on the idea that more guns and easier access makes us safer?
Well, there seems to be quite a bit of difference on this, in part reflecting some of the political differences in the country at large. So many states have now adopted statutes that are very permissive in being allowed to carry guns outside the home. And then states such as California, where I live, and New York, and a number of other states are much more restrictive. And that's a very tense both political and judicial debate at this moment.
And I'm guessing that there might also be differences between people who are gun owners and people who are not. I'm thinking of a recent Pew study that says 2/3 of gun owners say protection is a major reason why they own that firearm.
Yeah, clearly in the United States, many people think they will be safer with guns. Interestingly, in other countries that are more restrictive, that attitude is much less widespread.
Well, let's cut right to the chase. According to this new study, of which you were one of the lead authors, does the presence of more guns make us safer?
Well, what we did was we looked at 33 states that adopted right-to-carry laws and compared how they did to control states. And what we found is that after about 10 years after adoption of a right to carry law, violent crime was 13% to 15% higher than it would have been had the state not adopted right to carry laws. So the evidence seems to suggest allowing more concealed carry outside the home contributes to an increase in violent crime.
And what happens in those years between adoption and the point where crime is increasing?
You know, it's sort of a straight trend upwards. Essentially, you're getting about a, you know, 1% to 1.5% increase in violent crime per year that the right to carry law is in effect, although we did only look for the 10 years following adoption.
You've been quoted as saying that the Wayne LaPierre quote that we heard, that stopping bad guys who have guns is, quote, inaccurate, misleading, and somewhat offensive. Can you explain why you feel that way?
Well, somewhat offensive in that if you remember the horrible shooting of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords in Arizona a number of years ago, she was not stopped by anyone, or the killer was not stopped by anyone with a gun, but was rather stopped by a 74-year-old retired Army colonel who had been shot himself and jumped on top of the shooter when he was reloading. And indeed, if you look at the evidence on this, many more mass shootings are stopped by unarmed individuals than are stopped by individuals carrying concealed handguns. Of course, police are the primary avenue for stopping these mass shootings, and there's no question that armed police and armed security guards do a very good job.
And so in the states where there is the most extensive access to personal firearms and where there are the fewest restrictions on where they can be carried, and you saw this increase in gun violence, what do you attribute it that to? How do you tie those pieces together?
Well, it turns out there are many avenues with which guns interact with crime. Of course, the beneficial uses of guns are that they can at times be used to thwart crime or deter crime. So that's the good use. But we've seen just in the last couple of weeks some of the dark uses of guns being carried outside the home. So we saw the case in Pennsylvania where an individual driver was angry that an 18-year-old girl had cut in front of him, he thought, in a merging situation. He pulled out a gun and shot her in the head and killed her. And then about a week and a half ago in Seattle, I believe it was, a man coming back with his wife from a wedding in an Uber got into an argument with his wife and also a concealed carry holder, and he pulled out a gun and shot her in the head. So these are people who almost certainly would not have committed those crimes had they not been allowed to carry a concealed weapon outside the home. So that's one avenue through which things can go wrong. But of course, another very important and major impetus to crime is the fact that concealed carry owners lose and have their guns stolen a lot. They frequently are leaving their guns in cars, and the criminals know this and break into cars and steal the guns and use them for crime themselves or sell them to other criminals. So in a sense, concealed carry holders are often unwittingly arming criminals, and that obviously causes problems for, violent crime in the state.
John Donahue is a professor at the Stanford Law School, and he's one of the lead authors on a recent study done by the National Bureau of Economic Research on whether more people with guns leads to increased public safety or not. And John, when did this idea that is held as a fundamental truth for a lot of people, gun rights advocates and others, that this good guy with a gun is the answer to a bad guy with a gun, when did this idea first kind of gain traction?
Well, of course, the United States is awash with guns, and so people are trying to figure out ways how to deal with that problem. And the NRA has been a very effective lobby in this regard. But I think if you look around the country, for example, I mean around the world, for example, to other countries that have struggled with these issues, one sees that it is often far more effective to try to limit the influence of guns in society rather than to propagate that influence.
And John, what have been the trends in the last couple decades, maybe in states' regulation of personal firearms? What direction are we going in?
Well, I think a lot of the direction at the state level has been towards these more permissive gun laws. And of course, that has had a relatively pernicious effect in the states that have gone down that path. The NRA is currently suing the states that are more restrictive on gun carrying to try to overturn those laws. There's such a lawsuit going on in California right now. And they're also trying to get Congress to pass laws that would allow reciprocity so that you could carry, your gun from another state into, let's say, California, which doesn't permit permissive right to carry. And so those are two ways in which the NRA is trying to overcome the will of the voters in the states that have tried to restrict carrying of guns outside the home.
We're talking about new research that indicates that the good guy with a gun theory is not true. John Donahue was one of the lead authors of the study, which was done by the National Bureau of Economic Research.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the idea that more good guys with guns can make us all safer? If you support fewer restrictions on who can carry a firearm and where, does this data do anything to change your mind? Where do you think the balance is between the right to own a gun and public safety concerns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now about the latest research on whether the presence of more guns makes us more or less safe. John Donahue is a Stanford researcher and was one of the lead authors of a new study.
And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you own a gun for protection? Do you feel like you could make the difference in a mass shooting situation? If you don't carry a gun, do you feel more or less safe knowing that people around you may be carrying a firearm? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to our first caller, Chris in Stevens Point. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious. I may have misunderstood, but the study was just looking at the states that have permissible carry or permissible concealed carry and the change in violent crime. I'm wondering if the study also looked at states that don't allow carry and what the change over the same time or maybe about the same time period in their violent crime rates were. A lot of times gun studies to either side tend to pick and choose data that supports their argument, and that's kind of my question.
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. So, John, can you explain? So you said that about 10 or so years out from these new regulations, you saw an increase in crime. What about crime increases or decreases in the places that didn't make those legislative changes?
Yes, great question. And indeed, as the question suggests, there's a right way to do these statistical analyses and a wrong way. We did look very carefully at what happened across the United States. And just to give you the briefest statistical overview, if you compare violent crime in the states that never adopted right-to-carry laws from 1977 to the present, they experienced a roughly 45% drop in violent crime over that period. The states that did adopt got about a 9% drop, so much more drop in crime in the states that were more restrictive. And in the analysis that we did, we looked very carefully at relevant control states that had not adopted and compared them over the same 10-year period after the 33 states adopted to see how crime changed after adoption. And the conclusion was quite robust, 13 to 15% higher rate of violent crime in the 10 years after adoption.
Let's go back to the phones, and Joe in Eagle is up next. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
Good, good. So as I was flipping through the stations, I overheard the professor talking about he doesn't believe that the guns in the hands of civilians and permissible carry would deter crime. And I believe there is studies out there that show completely different. The reason it deters crime is that a criminal would approach somebody and obviously criminal intent, then that victim would display their firearm. Well, those types of events aren't as normally reported as, say, a full-blown shooting incident. So what my point would be hands in or guns in the hands of civilians will deter crime. And I believe that there's 300 million guns right now approximately in circulation, and I believe if guns were a problem, we would have more deaths on our hands than what we do now. Any death, I totally, you know, not condoning shooting, but at the same time, you know, they do help, I believe.
Thanks for that call, Joe. And John, how would you respond to Joe's point that it is a deterrent because criminals don't know who they're up against?
You know, as I said, to really answer the question, you have to look very carefully at the data in a nuanced way. And there are benefits from allowing citizens to carry concealed handguns, and there are also costs, the cost being, you know, some of the examples I was illustrating where people would not have committed a crime had they been restricted from carrying the guns, and also the fact that these guns get lost and stolen and then become available for criminals to use. And also, as we've seen in some unfortunate recent cases, the life of the police officer becomes more challenging when they have to confront armed citizens and sometimes hostile confrontations. We saw that in the Philando Castile case where a right to carry holder was shot 7 times by a police officer who clearly exhibited a great deal of stress and tension as soon as he heard that the guy in the car that he had stopped was carrying a weapon. So if you look at the data overall, whatever benefits you're getting from allowing citizens to carry concealed handguns seem to be more than outweighed by the burdens and costs of allowing citizens to carry concealed handguns.
And John, we have just about 30 seconds left, but very briefly, if more guns don't make us safer, what does?
Good policing is probably the single best public policy initiative that one could initiate. So that's always a good place. And of course, one of the burdens of the financial crisis that emanated at the end of the last Bush administration was that there was a lot of discharge of police and fire officials, and you're sort of seeing crime tick up in part because of that reduction in police forces.
John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John J. Donahue is a professor at the Stanford Law School. He was one of the lead authors on the recent study done by the National Bureau of Economic Research that debunked the good guy with a gun theory.
Last August, Milwaukee endured its deadliest month in more than 2 decades. Since then, there have been a number of efforts by city officials and community members to stop the violence. This week, WPR has been taking a closer look at gun violence in Milwaukee. In this final report, Ross Terrell speaks with people who are trying to end gunfire.
Khalil Coleman walks these streets of one of Milwaukee's high-crime neighborhoods looking for trouble or potentially violent situations.
What's going on, my brother?
But it's what he does when he encounters those situations that's different than most. Instead of running or calling the police, he intervenes.
Preventing violence isn't just something that special people can do. Preventing violence is something that all of us can do once we know what violence is and how to look for violence and how to look for threats and harm.
Coleman is the leader of Safe Zones, an initiative he helped start 2 years ago to help those affected by violence have a hand in preventing it.
Our approach is it take people from the community to help save the community. So we're not necessarily looking for outside parties, etc., to come into a community that they may not be from.
Last year, 81% of Milwaukee's homicide victims were shot. 84% of homicide victims so far this year have also been killed by gun violence. Quabena Antoine Nixon of Milwaukee is a motivational speaker. He says it's important violence prevention starts with kids, but the programs must do more than react.
Going and suspending a group of kids is reactive. What programs do we have that are proactive? Catch them doing something good or highlight the best of what it is, and they'll have people to aspire to be.
Antoine Nixon travels to local high schools to talk with those at the highest risk of falling into the cycle of violence. When Khalil Coleman started Safe Zones, it was funded by the city of Milwaukee. That support ended. Now, he is working to restore and expand funding in order to take the program citywide. Coleman says a lack of resources is a main factor that's stopping prevention practices from spreading.
I don't think that there's enough resources for this type of practice. When we look at the amount of money that's spent on mass incarceration, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's being spent on prevention.
Coleman says spending more money on prevention efforts doesn't mean just adding more police.
Police are called when? After a situation has occurred. So there's no prevention taking place in that method. The prevention is the community who know what may be happening at what particular time.
Janice Gordon works to help those already affected by violence cope and handle financial issues. She says prevention agencies need to work together to take advantage of the limited resources.
There's so many different small agencies all struggling to get their part done. But I think that if we were to pull together somehow, I think we could make a bigger impact.
Coleman says despite the challenges efforts such as his are facing, there's still one thing that can be done to help prevent violence.
We got to know our neighbor. I can't be a stranger in my own community. That's one thing that we can do with no resources, with no money, with no support from the city to do that, to say hi to your brother, to say hi to your sister.
He says after community members commit to knowing their neighbors, they must be willing to give people who are formerly incarcerated a second chance. Lastly, he says violence prevention comes down to holding people accountable on all levels, from police officers to city officials to each other. Ross Terrell, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is the final installment of a three-part series looking at gun violence in Milwaukee. The other two stories can be found on WPR.org.